event. But I really want to thank Geza and the other organizers here for this incredible opportunity to be able to come and share some exciting ideas that I'm excited about with such a range of really wonderful colleagues and friends to be able to be here. So for my talk today, first, just want to introduce myself. I'm actually an evolutionary ecologist, and I'm actually in that intellectual valley between theoreticians and empiricists. So yes, I try to do both, probably rather as a dilettante. So one of the hats that I wear is I'm a field ecologist. We have opportunities to work in a number of places then studying ecological systems. But I'm also extremely excited about evolutionary game theory. And in this talk today, it'll be really fun to amplify and move some of the ideas that Ulf just so beautifully presented. But first, I want to just pause. My game theory mentor, who got me enthusiastic about evolutionary game theory, was Tom Vincent, who unfortunately died in 2009. But in a volume published in Evolutionary Ecology Research, you'll find a fair number of papers by people who are sitting right here in the audience, which is absolutely wonderful, that I think provides a really wonderful introduction to anybody that wants to get familiar with the current state of evolutionary game theory. Well, a couple of quick observations to kind of put this talk on the intellectual map. Nature is a complex dynamical system. Nature is hierarchical, all the way from molecules to ecosystems, and nature is the product of evolution by natural selection. It's that third aspect they're going to be interested in here. And so the goals here is to present a bit of game theory, the type of game theory that Ulf does, Geza does, I do, Jürgen Riepen, and a number of people sitting here in the audience, talk a little bit about niche coevolution. Then I want to kind of see if we can ramp things up and actually start to use evolutionary game theory to look at issues in taxonomy and phylogenetics and finally see that kind of next frontier of evolutionary game theory, which would be macroevolution. So first off, I'll just show my biases. So purely a propaganda slide here. I may be completely wrong, I feel then that evolutionary game theory is in fact the natural logic, the natural language for understanding evolution by natural selection. Where does that come from? Well, if you take Darwin's postulates, and there's a number of ways that these are put in evolution textbooks. In fact, I generally don't like the way they're in evolution textbooks personally, but obviously I'm biased. And I actually like the way that Lewontin, way back in the 60s, and is now sort of forgotten, defined sort of Darwin's postulates. He had no postulates. He had just kind of long-winded but wonderful arguments that he put together. Heritable variation, which is a statement of genetics, the recipe of inheritance. Struggle for existence, which is just a statement of ecology, pure ecology. All populations have the capacity to grow exponentially under ideal conditions, but there are limits to growth. No population can grow exponentially forever. And then postulate number three kind of puts them together, and that is variation aids the struggle. Natural selection gets studied in a number of ways. One, of course, is and has been for a long time through the recipe of inheritance, through the genetics. Now, of course, we see a lot of fascinating and wonderful studies coming via phylogenies, and also it can be studied through the fit of form and function, the actual adaptations of the organisms themselves. What are some of the trends that we've seen, just to kind of take us down memory lane? Ulf did very nicely for the niche, is you have the rediscovery of Mendel's laws, and I'm actually going to argue, and I'll be happy to discuss with you later over a beer, probably the rediscovery of Mendel's law set our understanding of natural selection back decades. I'll throw that out as a statement, because the modern synthesis really had nothing to do with fit of form and function. It had all to do with, which was great, trying to reconcile then genetics, population genetics, which was seen as the lingua franca then of evolutionary thinking, then with modern systematics. But interestingly, if you look back, our sense of adaptation actually kind of disappeared. So there was that golden age of population genetics. It must have been amazing. Every time you turned over a stone, you were able to publish it with something new and exciting, led to the genetics research program, evolution is change in gene frequency. And then 1950s onwards, sort of the proto-game theory, was the realization then of quantitative traits leading to quantitative genetics. This led to three contexts of evolution by natural selection. The first, in fact, these were shown very nicely in those adaptive landscapes, is density-independent selection. Then you have a completely rigid landscape, and then it's easy. Evolution by natural selection simply selects for the characteristic that maximizes population growth rate, per capita growth rate. And then you enter density-dependent selection. That worked very, very well. Sewell, Wright, and Crowd were able to figure out that now what happens is you climb the peak, but the peak kind of sinks.
And under pure density-dependent selection, then you wind up with adaptations that maximize carrying capacity. These seem to be the adaptations that maximize efficiency. But then there was the sort of the big bad wolf of evolution, and that was frequency-dependent selection. You could model it genetically, and you had an outcome. The genes went somewhere, but all notions of what was optimized went out the window. So that's why we have this legacy now of, if you look at evolutionary textbook, frequency-dependent selection is kind of that bad boy that gets kind of hermetically sealed away, despite the fact that probably almost all evolution is frequency-dependent and probably the most interesting. So that kind of enters game theory, because game theory then not only can be used for these frequency-dependent processes, it embraces them. If you consider all the various fields that Darwin talks about in The Origin of Species, almost all of them are highly frequency dependent, simply meaning that my best strategy depends upon the strategies of others. It's a good thing that Darwin was not a major critical writer in the newspapers on Shakespeare. I love this quote from Darwin on Shakespeare. "I've tried lately to read Shakespeare and found it so intolerably dull that it nauseated me." Yeah, So life is a game, comes fairly naturally, as I'm trying to kind of hopefully convince you that it is organisms then represent the players, heritable traits represent the strategies. Interestingly, compared to regular game theory, sorry guys, you inherit your traits, you don't get to choose your strategies. Per capita growth rate ultimately then is the unit or is the payoff, or the fitness payoff, although we often use surrogates. And then the environment, and that feedback with the environment then actually determines the rules. So trends in evolutionary game theory is actually really exciting. In fact, I would argue then that really the 1990s, these 2000s, are maybe perhaps the golden age of evolutionary game theory. We start, of course, with a Hungarian. Isn't that wonderful? Right here, we're in Propria. We start with a Hungarian with game theory itself back in 1944. Nash comes up intriguingly with the no-regret strategy, which was a critical breakthrough for classical game theory. Interestingly, it turns out to be a necessary condition for an ESS, which is really kind of a delightful, kind of happy coincidence. You've got Maynard Smith and Price introducing sort of what we think of as matrix game theory. Auslander, George Oster, a number of other scientists actually began and introduced continuous evolutionary game theory. We have Eshel that identified this interesting property of convergence stability as well as being on the peak of a landscape. What I'm enthusiastic about with Tom Vincent was the introduction of the fitness generating function, which I'm going to use as the basis of the talk today. And then in the 1990s, it's just great. You have this explosion, adaptive speciation, evolutionary branching, wonderful ideas. You have various strategy dynamics, adaptive dynamics, Darwinian dynamics. Wonderful aspects of evolutionary game theory. I'm going to make a really horrible plug. I wish a number, of course, people are here of those authors. I wish Ava was here and Stefan. But actually, Garrett's et al., 1998, arguably, but I'm going to give it actually best evolutionary game theory paper of the 1990s. And the fact that that paper's been cited almost 500 times is incredibly deserved. It's wonderful. Then there's niche coevolution. We have Jürgen and Lena sitting here, which is really wonderful. And labs all over the place. And then right now, Ulf, yes, I will give you the award for most productive evolutionary game theorist of the last 10 years in terms of exciting ideas. Basically, how do we construct this function, this kind of adaptive function that Ulf was using to draw his landscapes? We recognize there's heritable variation. That means organisms have a strategy, and it's drawn from some set of evolutionarily feasible strategies, presumably based on genetic constraints, other sorts of things. There's that struggle for existence. We have this idea then that there's a per capita growth rate. Tom and I always like to use G then for this per capita growth rate. And all it recognizes then is that at some point, if population size X is sufficiently large, per capita growth rate is negative. So somewhere along the way, beyond the Allele effect, beyond everything else, there is some point at which population is so big that any species is going to experience negative population size. And then how does we form then a function for how variation influences the struggle? What we do is construct then a function in which I can determine my per capita growth rate. You determine the per capita growth rate then of some focal individual, some invader, some mutant, by considering V to be the strategy of that focal individual, that's me. But then my fitness is influenced by all the other the strategies found in the population. That's just going to be that vector of U. That's everybody else. And then everybody else has a population size, which recognizes then density-dependent processes. And then you can come up with just a really nice set of ecological and evolutionary equations that also nicely used in his talk, because that function actually simultaneously gives us the ecological dynamics. Changes in population size is determined then by setting the focal strategy to whatever happens to be the species in the environment. And it also then gives rise to the strategy dynamics, in which we see evolution by natural selection as that kind of hill climbing exercise, pushing it up the hill, in which we then have the rate of evolution is then determined by both the gradient of the fitness landscape and then the additive genetic variance that happens to be in the population. This is sort of a game theoretic statement of Fisher's fundamental theorem of natural selection, or what you can have, which is fun, possibly then Jim's hybrid species, things like this, is the fact that communities may be invasion structured, either from allopatric, parapatric events, bringing in somebody who's made a quantum or saltatorial leap in strategy. How do you make an evolutionary game? All of you can go out there and do this. It's really fun. Select your favorite model of population dynamics. We often will use Locke de Volterra equations, but you don't have to. Pick your favorite model of population dynamics. Decide what you think are the salient and interesting strategies. Place bounds on what is evolutionarily feasible for your critter, and then introduce those strategies of the individuals, of yourself, the focal individual, the strategies of others, into that model of population dynamics. So then what happens? How do you actually go about then finding these ESSs, or the outcome then of evolution? Well, one of them is using the adaptive dynamics. And as we saw in Ulf's talk, so I'll just go through this really quickly, one of the really most important features is to recognize this phenomenon, this escalator effect, in which each of these frames are mimicking what Ulf showed us very beautifully, that the ecological dynamics always put you at the waterline. So Ulf's sea level is that zero. I don't have those lovely colors. Darn, I want to borrow some of your slides. But zero is the waterline. Sorry, it's not bright, it's not dark. But we have our extant species there, sitting there as a circle, and in each of these frames, and again, better people in here could make me a lovely cartoon of this, every time it evolves up the landscape, it loses whatever was gained through changes in population size. So the escalator effect actually moves you sideways along zero until you finally hit that point then that has that property of being convergence stable and also being maximizing fitness. And as Ulf also showed, you may be moving along according to the escalator effect, but in fact then the strategy dynamics places you at a minimum. So picking up on that idea is we can make a model of competition. So many of us have played with these competition models based on the Locke de Volterra competition model, in which carrying capacity is a function of my strategy, and then the competitive interactions are somehow a function of my strategy and then the strategies of others. And these models are fun because they basically can illustrate most of the phenomenon that we're interested in looking at. So for instance, here's a model that, there it goes. If you have a single species, it evolves to that minimum. You have that sort of tantalizing peak on one side. You've got that big sort of running up forever. On the other side, you let the thing speciate, evolutionary branching. And then the same model. So this is now the same model. I haven't changed at all the ecological circumstances, anything other than the feedback that's going on. And now what happens is the two species that speciate at that point, they go to nice peaks on the adaptive landscape. But as also say, there's not community closure because you still have this other peak, but you can't get there through evolutionary branching. You're stuck. There's this valley. There's no way you can quite get to that point. So now you have convergence stability to a local evolutionary maxima. And in fact, this may be our best definition then of an empty niche, that term out there for empty niche. And in this case, it's kind of cool because evolutionary branching essentially says sympatric or adaptive speciation can fill out those opportunities. But on the other hand, it can't fill out that opportunity. So maybe that is a role for either saltatorial evolution or allopatric speciation that brings in something from somewhere else. So let's go ahead and let something cross the river, something that was geographically isolated, that coincidentally is on the other side of the peak. And finally, we then have convergence stability then to a global maximum. So first, what does that say about kind of this evolutionary process within a G function? So within a G function, it sets up this sort of adaptive radiation, and then what we kind of have termed niche coevolution, where if we have a five-strategy ESS, all of these four situations, none of them are ESS yet, represent convergent stable situations. So what we, Tom and I, actually have termed this is niche archetypes. These, in a sense, is, you might be able to define a niche archetype then is any set of convergent stables. So if you want an evolutionary niche definition, any configuration of convergent stable points might represent niche archetypes. Whether they're filled or not, these actually exist in the abstract. They exist in any model. And what we see is you can start to see the adaptive radiation unfolding. Because here, evolutionary branching will take us here. But notice, after you have the evolutionary branching, you go to these new points. This point, which was a strategy of 30, doesn't even exist anymore. It was way out here. Wow, so you get some really kind of wild niche coevolution going. So the guy that actually seemed really quite adaptive and ecologically would have looked just fine if you studied as an ecologist, as soon as it speciates, it actually is gone. And then we evolved to a peak and a valley. Let's have evolutionary branching. We wind up now at two peaks and a valley, but notice how these strategies are shifting. They're not the same strategy values anymore. And then it can speciate, but then darn, once you get in this particular model, it can vary with models, you wind up with four really nice species at maximum, but you still have this empty niche that represents a valley before you can jump over and fill out. And so Tom and I have kind of termed then the actual sort of peaks, the species that are at an ESS that's convergence stable, as the Darwinian niches, recognizing that along the way you can have all sorts of ecologically sensible configurations of the landscape. So this raises an empirical question that I think is wonderful, and that is ultimately the question then, are most species most of the time at or near their ESSs? Is a really great question. So if they are, then the world is mostly Darwinian niches. If they're at convergence stable points, then most of the world is at niche archetypes. Or in a world, maybe they're all on the slopes of these landscapes, maybe they're like those landscapes where you have all of those species that are sitting on the waterline of that multidimensional trait space, but they're not making much movement inland onto that island. So this I will just throw out as I think an incredibly interesting question. Does that Himalayan tar that kind of looks like a cross between a goat and a Wookiee, what do you think? Is it an ESS? Is it at a minimum? Or is it on its way to somewhere? The other result, though, that comes out of this analysis then of any of this evolutionary game theory is, in all due reference to my academic great-grandfather, Evelyn Hutchinson, who asked, why are there so many species? Actually, quite frankly, it turns the question around. What we begin to see in evolutionary game theory is really nature is a rather dull subset of what is evolutionarily feasible and what is ecologically acceptable. And the only time it's not is when you have infinite niche packing, as Ulf was talking about, where you get the full range of what's out there. So the first question then in applying these adaptive functions, the G function, is to ask the question, how big is the strategy set? Now, I think we do a great disservice in our evolution classes. I teach evolution classes. We want to emphasize genetic variability. So we stand up in front of the class. Do you have A blood, B blood, O blood? We ask, can you taste certain chemicals? How does your thumb look? How do your earlobes look? And my favorite, of course, can you roll your tongue? And everybody's sitting here, yep, I've still got it. No, never been able to do it. Some people are saying, you know, why would it even be selected for? The more interesting imaginations in here are wondering all sorts of fun sort of sexual selection things that maybe rolling your tongue was or was not useful for. But quite frankly, the genetic variability that we talk about in our evolution classes is boring, and it is not the stuff of evolution that we then talk about when we talk about the evolution of body size, the evolution of coloration in the Heliconus butterflies. So it does open up the question, how big is that real set of evolutionary feasible strategies? Not whether my dog can roll its tongue or not roll its tongue. And actually, domestic dogs provide wonderful insight. So here I put up domestic dogs just to point out, and this is just going to be a conjecture. This is going to just simply invite people to think big. But that is, if you consider the smallest dog, I don't know, how many people have ever had that fantasy of kicking a soccer goal with a little tiny dog? I know it's bioethically not right, but yeah, when you see those little yappy dogs, there's this incredible temptation to drop kick them. Does anybody have that fantasy in here? Is it just me? Shoot, maybe it's just me anyway, and you have the Irish Wolfhound and some of the large. So you have two orders of magnitude difference in the body size. You've got dogs that look like you stuck their nose in a pencil sharpener. You have dogs that look like you peeled their face off of a Mack truck. You have dogs that look like they're running on stilts, and dogs that you'd love to run with and just see how fast they can move those little legs as they're going on. Tail length, coat color, all the other things. But the fact is, domestic dogs is considered one species. It gives us amazing insights into the evolutionarily feasible strategy set. And it, too, is only the tip of the iceberg, because those are the dogs, for whatever reason, we want. Imagine all the dogs that could be, that nobody adopted. You know, the asymmetric dog with legs different lengths, that's for running in one direction around mountains. And then the dog that has the reverse leg length for going the other direction. So what I'm going to suggest to you, and it's just very crude, this is just the beginning, but I want to get sort of get people's imagination going, that it seems that perhaps as a first cut, with lots of, that if you're making a G function, what you really have done is written the adaptive function for the taxonomic level family. So I'm just going to kind of throw out that kind of weird thought. It clearly is bigger than a species. And if two species can interbreed or hybridize, clearly they have to be part of the same G function. So I don't think it is just a mathematical construct. And what I'd like to suggest, and is there may be a reality to this. So let's just really quickly look at modern taxonomy. The goal is, of course, the tree of life. Phylogenies aim for these monophyletic groupings. Terminal branches represent these sort of taxonomic units. The deeper branches, phylogenetics and taxonomy, now teaches us have no specific meaning. They're sort of artificial constructs that we use to lump things. And then, of course, there's problems with higher taxonomic units, such as orders and families. Are they polyphyletic or monophyletic? And then finally, what I really love in modern taxonomy is many of them pride themselves in being agnostic in terms of what is the evolutionary force. Is it species selection? Is it natural selection? Is it genetic drift? Is it just this inherent capacity to bud off species that are on there? So this is kind of where this is worked with. But I want to suggest a few things. These are two of the species of squirrels I work with. I love squirrels. All else equal, that's what I would play with and work with. We have the eastern gray squirrel. That's the scourge of Buckingham Palace there in St. James Park in England. And then over there we have the eastern fox squirrel. And the reason why I would argue they're very much part of the same G function, both of them live in my backyard, as species, is because really only three traits. You would need then a multidimensional trait space of three. Olf would just need to go up one more dimension, and you have what describes it to you. The two of them differ in body size. Yes, they differ in body size, they differ in coat color, and they differ in kind of their personality and temperament. I think we would also agree that these two are different G functions. Whereas you might be able to evolve a fox squirrel into a gray squirrel, I think we would agree then that my cat there really doesn't have that squirrel as part of its current evolutionary strategy set. Or it would be tricky to get there. There's some big valleys, there's some big genetic problems in getting there. So this raises the idea then that there may be different G functions, and just to kind of point out what that means is it helps define the problem. These are all the current families that are recognized in carnivora. So up here we got the mycelids, we've got the raccoons, we got our seals and sea lions, we have our dogs, we have our hyenas, that confuses people. Down here you got the vivarids and the mongooses, and you have the cats. And so I'm arguing that each of these may be best thought of as a different G function. But let's take the raccoon family. Well, when we get to the raccoon family, these are raccoons, these are coatis. These are ringtails, and this is this wonderful animal. Google it, they look great, the kinkajou. What's neat is we look across all of these species, at in any given place, at most you have three members. You'll have a procyon, you'll have a coatimundi, you'll have a basiriscus. So that's neat. That tells us that all of these guys are likely united by the same fitness landscape, and so hence we can expect them to occupy or be driven then by sort of three peaks on the landscape. And so I think that, in fact, in modern taxonomy, G functions may allow us to recognize then this hierarchy then of less repeatable and reversible changes. And so that even though right now modern taxonomists don't consider family to have any meaning, it would be pretty funny and wonderful if that family level represents that kind of transition between things that are easy to evolve and things that are rather tough to evolve. So I'm going to offer this definition of macroevolution. I'm going to define then as a thought that microevolution then may be easily repeatable and reversible evolutionary changes within a G function. Going from a fox squirrel to a gray squirrel probably would not be hard, or vice versa. But macroevolution are those non-repeatable, irreversible changes. They're just tough. They're tough to get that create new G functions. And I'm going to also then point out something important when we make that distinction. One is, in microevolution then, rates of evolution should be rapid and very directed. And we should be able to make statements like, a change in temperature, so I'm going to pick on the global climate change people, a change in temperature caused an increase in body size, which is basically saying the peak shifted with temperature. But I love this. You will often hear, it's in the textbooks. It is in the experts. C4 plants evolved 20 million years ago in response to the drop in CO2. I love that statement. I love that statement. I mean, that's it. That's the current state of our knowledge. But C4 photosynthesis has got to be a new G function. You guys are not going to come up with corn from wheat. You might get barley. You might get rye. You might get all sorts of wonderful cold season grains. But I'm sorry, good luck, guys. Getting C4 photosynthesis from a C3 grass is not microevolution. It's a new G function. So you cannot say the drop in carbon dioxide levels caused. No, it did not cause, which in fact is cool, because then what does that suggest? You heard it here first. Get your science paper, rewrite. What does it suggest? The evolution of this new G function caused the drop in CO2. More than that, maybe it created the non-equilibrium dynamic we call ice ages. So maybe ice ages and CO2 fluctuations in the atmosphere is just a non-equilibrium dynamic between C4 plants, C3 plants, and atmospheric CO2. You heard it here. We'll try to find that in the literature. Who knows? But what it does say then is microevolution is generally in response to changes in the environment. Macroevolution are those evolutionary events in which life changes the world forever that are out there. So how do we make a novel G function? Just kind of want to run through. Here's our standard Locke de Volterra. But what we do is we just throw in another parameter, gamma. And this gamma we let take on different values, but it's a macro change. You don't get to change it. So you have sort of different than G functions. So one possibility, can I take like 5 more minutes? 3, okay, I'll take 3 minutes. Okay, that'll kind of odd. So one is you may actually have better G functions. So over here we have a rattlesnake. Over here we have a viper. The big difference, they look very similar, they do very similar things, is that this guy has infrared eyeballs. It has an extra set of eyes. And those infrared pits perhaps make it a better G function. What happens when you have a better G function? We'll start with green. That's the happy starting world. And then what happens is then along comes our pit viper. It has then, in general, entirely everywhere, a better G function. So when you have more than one G function, you have different adaptive landscapes. So when you have one G function, everything's happening on one landscape. So what happens is this guy can come in. Notice he's got both ecological and evolutionary potential. Eventually, of course, this guy will reach its ecological equilibrium and begin to snuff out this poor guy. And then eventually it can evolve to the peak. The other possible is you just have different G functions. Here you have granivorous birds, gallinaceous birds, and you have rodents feeding on seeds. What happens there is you have three possibilities. This actually gets into the idea that maybe G functions have fundamental and realized niche. In this scenario, this new G function can't even make it. It comes in, it has no hope. Another intriguing possibility that raises some ideas of Gomolka-Witz and Holt to the level of G functions is the G function has potential. It could do well, but darn, the current representative of that G function is kind of a loser. But maybe it somehow manages to kind of make it in, and eventually you can arrive at a new ESS. But notice we now have more species diversity. Or furthermore, the new G function may provide a species that has excellent fitness, can invade very, very easily, and as a consequence, it can enter the community ecologically, and then eventually evolve then to an ESS. All of these are possible. And then finally, they can be multi-species. So here we're starting with a G function that has 3 species. We now introduce a new G function that also has 3 species. And what we see then is we lose a species, but we add 2 or 3 new species. And so this could be, for instance, competition between hummingbirds, hawk moths. And we've been working with these and looking at their distribution, but I'm going to skip ahead on these because I want to give you the points that I want to get. because there's eventually predator-prey coevolution. Let's skip that because I want to get to the points then. What are the consequences of different G functions? I'm going to suggest that when G functions are on the same trophic level, each of them reduces the diversity in the other, but increases overall diversity. And that when you have G functions on different trophic levels, they tend to amplify species diversity. Just a hypothesis. And then this might explain some of the trends in evolution. We may be seeing over the history of life a slow buildup of these evolutionary technologies, these G functions. So it may explain that, in fact, biodiversity is trending up. It's not just an artifact of the recent. Furthermore, large continents probably produce more G functions than small continents. That would explain why islands are so vulnerable, why Australia is so vulnerable to the rest of the world. And also it may explain why species area relationships do not operate in reverse. Based on our theory of species area relationships, many, many more species should have gone extinct with human disturbance, but they haven't. One idea, Stuart Pym, it's extinction debt. They're not. They're walking dead. They're just slowly on their way out. Or Mike Rosenzweig's reconciliation ecology. There's actually more habitat out there than we think. But one possibility is the process that builds up G functions may be different than extinction. So by conclusion, then, I'd like to suggest and invite you to think of evolutionary game theory, adaptive dynamics, as a modeling tool for evolution and ecology above the species level. I think we can use it to link micro and macro evolution, and it may finally provide that synthesis that didn't happen between natural selection, phylogenies, and microevolution. And then the real question for people like Ulf and I, Gaze and I, is how do we make this applicable to empiricists? Ulf gave us some nice examples, and then Gaze is going to do this. How do we get this in the textbooks? Thanks very much. Sorry.
No problem. So, yeah, thank you.